Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Last night at our closing reception, I met with a entrepreneur here in Singapore who is working on expanding farm-raised fish for the Singaporean market.
So last week, trade mission participants heading home after a successful U.S. ag trade mission to Southeast Asia. Alexis Taylor is Undersecretary for Ag Trade.
And they're partnering, again, with U.S. Companies to import soybeans, corn, U.S. feed ingredients for that farm-raised fish sector. So, again, I think there are real practical things going on in these markets that are benefiting farmers that we saw this week.
This is Agriculture Today.
Using data from the USDA, today we're going to look at how U.S. milk supply has been evolving over the past two decades across the top 15 dairy-producing states in the country.
Dr. Jared Hutchins is a University of Illinois ag economist.
In our dairy sector, there really are two different types of states, which I will call modern and traditional states, which are evolving in very different ways. As you can see from this map, the most obvious distinguishing factor in these types of states is geography. Modern dairy states are out west, and the traditional dairy states are in the Midwest and Northeast. Other distinguishing factors are history and how big their operations are. Traditional dairy states have a much longer history in dairy, hence the name traditional, and their herd sizes are usually less than 250 cows. In contrast, the modern dairy states are more recent entries into the sector, and their average herd size tends to be well over 1,000. In this presentation, the only real distinction I've drawn is whether the state has an average herd size below or above 500 head. I've chosen these 15 states because they are the top 15 states in terms of dairy cow numbers. For these states, I'm going to be breaking down both total production and average herd size in terms of its base components, which are milk yield, number of cows, and number of farms. The first observation we can make looking at total production is that traditional and modern dairy states are actually producing about the same amount of production and growth. However, they are doing it in very different ways. First, let's look at cow numbers. Traditional dairy states have barely added any cows since 2008, but modern dairy states added cows at a quick rate since 2000. After 2008, the rate of cow growth in modern dairy states has gone down and even started to slightly stagnate in the past 2 years. Now let's look at the other way to grow production, milk yield, measured in pounds of milk per cow. Dairy farms can grow yield by investing in better technology, adopting better management practices, and using genetics with higher milk yield. Modern dairy states have a higher milk yield than traditional dairy states, but starting in 2012, we're actually seeing traditional dairy states close this gap. If we normalize both trends to their 2010 level, we can see that milk yield in traditional dairy states has started to catch up in 2012. This is interesting because starting in 2010, we've also seen large improvements in dairy genetics thanks to the introduction of genomic testing. Finally, let's look at average herd size. Once again, I've normalized herd size to the 2003 level so we can compare the two regions on the same graph. Beginning in 2014, we see that average herd size has started growing faster in traditional dairy states. Since we know they are not adding cows, we know that herd size has to be driven by a decline in the number of dairy farms. In fact, from 2014 to 2020, the number of operations in traditional dairy states has gone down 37%, compared to 26% in modern dairy states. So what's the future of U.S. dairy production look like? Well, one question we might ask is whether we are reaching a long-term stable number of dairy cows in the country. We've seen both production and cow numbers slightly stagnate in the last 2 years, but it remains to be seen if this will continue. Some issues that the dairy sector needs to confront are environmental regulation and zoning that may limit expansion, as well as worries about the resiliency of the supply chain. These kinds of factors may lead to these states deciding to no longer grow production by adding cows. If we've reached that long-term level, we may see modern dairy states start following the example of traditional dairy states and focus on growing yield to expand production instead of cow numbers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
$28.7 million was raised this past campaign year for the National FFA Foundation, speaking with Jim Williams of the foundation. So, Jim, first tell me about what this number means.
This is exciting. This is an all-time record-setting year when it comes to fundraising. So it's the highest that we've ever raised. I'd like to thank some key corporate partners like Tractor Supply Company and Cargill, who made multi-year commitments this year. We also had solid contributions from individuals who are personally passionate about what goes on at FFA. It was also a record-setting year when it comes to our Give FFA Day, which is a day every February where we ask FFA members to come together and make a gift either to National FFA or to a state FFA association. And this year we raised over $822,000 on that one day alone. So a lot of exciting things going on this year, and that's how we were able to achieve that goal.
Why do you think it was a record-breaking year?
Well, I think it always helps for the ag economy to be doing pretty well, and we had several corporate partners who were in a position where they could make significant gifts at this time. Also, I think it's the message of FFA. People are excited to see what we're doing and growing the next generation of leaders to change the world. So thanks to the leadership of Scott Stump, CEO, and Molly Balls, the president of the foundation, Christine White, chief programming officer, they have done a good job of putting together strategic priorities that seem to be resonating both with our corporate partners as well as with our individual donors.
What ways are you trying to connect with FFA members through sponsorships?
So we connect several ways. Our corporate partners are really interested in National FFA as a future talent pipeline, and you know, their ability to connect with us and our programs and support events like the National Convention, get their name in front of those students, that gives them a chance for students to know where they can go to put their skills to work. We're also out on social media promoting those opportunities and really trying to find any National FFA event where we can bring our corporate partners to those students so that they have access to that talent pipeline.
Because really what you're trying to do is connecting industry to these FFA members that are younger.
You've got it. That's correct. We are trying to bring our donors to the foundation so that they can have an impact on students' lives today, so that hopefully those students can develop those skills that are going to allow them to be the leaders of tomorrow. And, you know, in all honesty, when it comes to fundraising, we want it to be a perpetual cycle. So these students get the benefit today of the generosity of the donors that we have. And going forward, they themselves will become donors, either in making decisions as a corporate leader and deciding for their company to invest in National FFA, or as individuals, they see an opportunity to provide an impact and make a difference in students' lives.
What do you hear from these sponsors as they see FFA members walking across the stage and doing really cool things with some special projects?
Oh, it's a bucket-filling experience. Life-changing is another one that I hear. We have several representatives from corporate partners as well as individual donors who either have not attended a convention in a long time, as in when they were a student, or have never attended one. And when they see 70,000 students coming together in Indianapolis, I hear nothing but compliments about how great those students are, the difference that they're making, the exciting things that they're doing through our programs and competitive events. And it's really a life-changing experience, not just for the students who get to go through those FFA experiences, but also for those corporate partners and individual donors who are providing those students with the resources to make an impact.
For your last words here, what would you say the impact on the Blue Corduroy Jacket has on you personally?
Well, I have been at National FFA Foundation for 5.5 years, and every day I get to hear stories about the amazing things that students are doing.
National FFA Foundation, a record-breaking year this past campaign year, and looking forward to here in the future. For National FFA, I'm Michelle Stengler.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The main reason it's so much different is because everybody gets to benefit from that.
Steve Verrett is the former CEO for Plains Cotton Growers.
We're so thankful as producers that we have, whether it's crop insurance or whether it might be some kind of ad hoc disaster or whatever. But when your product that you're growing is restricted or not grown or whatever, then that's taken out of the whole supply chain and everybody that handles it and processes it. And so when you're able to grow a crop, take it all the way to harvest and process it and put it into the marketplace, everybody gets to take advantage of that and benefit from that. And so from an economic perspective for a growing region, it just means everything. And so that's the other thing that's got folks excited, because it's been a tough a couple of years, especially on our ginning industry, because of the decreased volume. Most of these gins are at a point that they have to have significant volume to be profitable. And the last couple of years have been pretty tough on them.
But the industry has overcome challenges before. Challenges like the boll weevil.
Well, you mentioned boll weevil. Certainly that was a big challenge early in my career when I came to Plains Cotton Growers. And thankfully, you know, we worked through some of those issues. And I guess when I think back, Tony, this is a prime example of what brings about success from challenges. And that's, you know, looking at it and having good, solid input from your volunteer leadership and the producers themselves. You know, whatever I've been able to accomplish or look at, even if going back when I farm full time, the fact that I benefited from farming with a brother and that we worked very well together and we had that family that we could rely on, it never was a me deal. It was a we deal. Everything we did was for the benefit of the farm that benefited all of our families. And then coming to an organization and working, it was much the same. And what I always wanted to try to do is to build coalitions and always be listening, have good grassroots support, grassroots leadership that keeps you focused in the right direction. It's important to have staff, good staff. I benefited from that. That's one of the things I always tried to, is to have the best people I could surrounding me, have people smarter than me, quite honestly, that could help do what we needed to do. But, you know, everything that we've accomplished is always been a team effort. And it depends on, maybe it was a small team on something that might be just specific to our region, or it might be something bigger. You know, when I look back and think about kind of one of the low points was when cotton was taken out of Title I. And, you know, we never gave up on getting that done, but that took a big coalition to get it done. And, we like to think that we had some part in that, and I believe that we did, but it was everybody working together and never giving up on that idea. And so, The strength of any organization like this is to have good volunteer leadership and involvement from the grassroots to make sure that what you're doing, that you're on track. And so I've benefited greatly from having good leaders around me and a good staff at the same time.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Ag Economy Barometer Index rose 4 points compared to a month earlier, and that leaves the barometer 8 points higher than it was a year ago, but 11 points below where it was 2 years ago.
Dr. Jim Mantert is director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture at Purdue.
The rise in the barometer was fueled by increases in both the current condition index and the future expectation index. The current condition index rose 3 points compared to last month, but was unchanged compared to a year ago. The future expectation index rose 5 points compared to last month. It was actually 12 points higher than it was in October of 2022. Financial performance index was also up this month. It was up 6 points compared to a month ago and a year ago, but left it 12 points below where it was 2 years ago. Once again this month, we asked producers about their biggest concerns for their farming operation in the upcoming year, and high input cost remains the number one concern, followed by rising interest rates and lower crop or livestock prices. Farm Capital Investment Index was down 4 points this month compared to a month earlier, and that left the index 3 points below where it was this time last year. When we asked producers who said it's a bad time to make large investments in the farming operation why they feel that way, over time we've noticed that there's an increasing percentage of farmers pointing to rising interest rates as a key factor. At 41% of them this month said that was the key factor. For the last 4 months, we've been asking producers who say it's a good time to make large investments in the farming operation why they feel that way. Back in July and August, 40 to 41% of the producers in the survey said it was because of strong cash flows. But in the last two surveys, that percentage has declined. And this month, just 24% of the producers in the survey who feel it's a good time to make large investments said it was because of strong cash flows. Farmers continue to remain relatively optimistic about farmland values. The long-term farmland value expectation index was actually up 3 points this month compared to a month earlier, and it's up 12 points compared to a year ago. The short-term index at the same time fell just 1 point below where it was a month earlier. Producers who expect values to rise continue to point to non-farm investor demand as a key reason for their optimism about farmland values. Given concerns about dry weather in much of the country this past summer, we asked producers if they've made some changes in their farm operations in response to long-term changes in weather. 24% of the producers in this month's survey said they have made some significant changes, and the responses indicate producers are adapting by using various technologies and capital investments. Key changes producers reported making were adopting the increased use of no-till, changing the mix of crops planted, and in some cases planting more drought-resistant varieties, as well as making some capital investments in things like irrigation and tile drainage.
One area he did mention, expiration of a farm bill. Dr. Bart Fisher with the Ag and Food Policy Center.
I'm getting lots of questions about farm bill expiration, but you know, I'll say for the most part, you know, we really don't have to worry, start worrying about, you know, a farm bill lapsing until really until the first of the year, because for the most part, farm policy in particular, and that's, you know, most of Title I, most of the things that are grower, you know, both farmer and rancher facing run through the calendar year or through the crop year. And so that takes us through the end of the year. And so there's really nothing catastrophic that happens on September 30th. And so, if you hear that Congress is not doing an extension, you know, in October or November, it's not due to dysfunction. It's due to the fact that it doesn't really have to be done, because nothing really bad starts happening. And even then, I think you've got some time in the new year as well. So I, you know, they may choose to do one this fall, but it won't surprise me if they don't, in part because they just want to keep the focus on getting a new farm bill in place. And so I think that's probably where their attention will stay.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is Lydia Johnson at the 96th National FFA Convention and Expo, and joined by Jim Bowerly with the United States Army Reserve. And Jim, you're promoting some programs to some of the students coming through.
Yes, I am. We've got two great programs to offer. We have one, which is an ROTC program in the Army Reserves. So you would go to ROTC at one of hundreds of colleges across the United States. And we'll pay your tuition. We'll give you $1,200 for books a year, pay you $420 a month as a stipend, and then you would join the Army Reserve. So one weekend a month, Saturday and Sunday, we'll give you 4 days pay for those 2 days' work while you're still in college or you're going along those lines. That's worth about $6,000 to $9,000. So in essence, we're paying all of your college tuition, all your room and board, your books and everything. But when you get commissioned, you have an 8-year obligation in the reserves. You don't go on active duty, so you don't leave your homeland. You stay here. So if you're a FFA farmer or forester or something in that industry and in leadership, you get to continue to do that. You can use that college degree that we paid for to get your civilian occupation going. So that's what one of the two programs. The other program, maybe you don't want to become an officer, don't want to do ROTC in college. Not a problem there either. We have a great program to just enlist in the Army Reserve. And here, by enlisting, we will send you to 16 weeks, normally between your high school and freshman year in college. Get trained, you get paid for doing that. You come back, you're in an Army Reserve unit, and we'll pay up to $50,000 in any college debt that you accumulate from that vantage point. You'll get a skill, and you get to choose the skill based upon your qualifications, one from, of about 150 different job opportunities that we have. Many of them relate to farming, in all honesty. So you can get to do that. One weekend again, you would go to your reserve unit, and you get paid 4 days' pay for that. You have a 6-year obligation in that program. It's a great opportunity, a great way to avoid building debt for school, great way for security if you're in the farming business, because we have life insurance, medical insurance, retirement opportunities, and things along those lines that are available to you in the Army Reserves.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Yeah. All is a part-time opportunity. So it was great. Great money, great benefits. Every month I get a retirement check. I've got all my medical coverage through TRICARE for Life. It's really a great, great long-term benefit.
What do you think the biggest, best-kept secret of joining the Army is?
for joining the Army is the learn a skill, the education opportunities and funding and availability for that, not just for college, but for skills. We have programs that provide money to get accreditation for special skills and things like that. We have testing abilities where you pass the test, you can get up to 3 college credits or accepted at any university across the United States, which adds to that. So you get the experience, you get the travel, you get the education opportunities, you get the camaraderie and get to move around and see parts of the world that you wouldn't have, and you get a skill that's highly transferable into the community. And that we have many more people in the farming industry and things like that for the students that would be here are involved after they get out of school than people would think. Why? Farming can be risky, and this is a great way to have some stability of income, stability of medical insurance, life insurance, additional education money to help push you through. So it's a wonderful, wonderful program, both the Army and the Army Reserve.
And that's Jim Byerly, a retired one-star general from the U.S. Army. This is Lydia Johnson for National FFA.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Under the Clean Water Act, it's unlawful to release pollutants into U.S. waters without a permit.
Government Accountability Office, or GAO, has been looking into this over the years. Alfredo Gomez with GAO.
EPA sets limits on the amount of pollutants that can be released from an industrial facility or a municipal wastewater treatment plant. For example, how much ammonia can be released? That's included in the permit.
So how many permits exist?
Currently, there are about 335,000 facilities with active permits. The category of facilities are complex, but they generally fall into major and non-major facilities. So the major facilities include municipal wastewater treatment plants that release more than 1 million gallons per day, and industrial facilities that are releasing higher levels of toxic pollutants. Major facilities account for about 7,000 facilities.
So how does EPA monitor the Clean Water Act?
EPA partners with states, with territories, and tribes to oversee the program. And what EPA does is EPA, with the states, conduct a variety of activities, including inspections and identifying violations. States are required to report on their inspections and enforcement activities to EPA. Facilities also monitor and report their pollutant discharge levels. This is important because this allows EPA to automatically calculate whether a facility is exceeding its discharge limits. And this helps EPA and the states track illegal discharges and pollution.
But is it possible to transition to electronic monitoring?
So EPA began in 2015 to require states and facilities to electronically report their program and permit information, such as inspections, discharge levels, and violations. This gives EPA one of the most comprehensive databases among the environmental programs that it administers to oversee the Clean Water Act. However, we found that there are issues with the completeness and accuracy of the data that EPA collects. For example, we found that only 2 of the 17 state programs that EPA reviewed had accurate and complete data. Also, the transition to electronic reporting is ongoing. There have been a number of challenges experienced by states and facilities during this transition. For example, some states have had problems entering facility permit limits into the database.
So maybe it's an obvious question, but what are the goals of the Environmental Protection Agency?
EPA does track and annually report results of its compliance and enforcement activities. For example, EPA sets a goal for pollution reduction that it hopes to achieve through its enforcement. It also periodically selects a set of national initiatives that identify priority areas for its compliance and enforcement programs. One of EPA's current set of initiatives focuses on the Clean Water Act, specifically improving water quality, by reducing the rate of significant noncompliance by a subset of permitted facilities. However, we found that inaccurate and incomplete permit limit and facility discharge data makes the results of EPA measures unclear.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
USDA Farm Service Agency makes direct and guaranteed farm ownership and operating loans to farmers and ranchers that can be used to purchase land, livestock, equipment, feed, seed, and supplies.
Examples of resources for veterans turned farmers, military veterans ag liaison Monshi Ramdas.
Loans can also be used to construct building or make farm improvements. Natural Resources Conservation Service provides voluntary no-fee technical assistance for conservation planning. Producers can apply for financial assistance, install conservation practices to meet their land management goals, and strengthen their operations. Veterans who are beginning producers may be eligible for higher financial assistance and or advance payment to install conservation practices.